our very specific analytic listening, we can help them to understand how this external terrible situation is reactivating their internal latent anxieties. And paradoxically, we try to confine their suffering to the momentaneous and virtual of the here and now of the phone call.
Welcome to the IPA podcast. For those of you who have been listeners to the past 40 episodes of this podcast series, you know that we've been focusing on analysts who bring their clinical skills to venues outside of the consulting room, hence the name psychoanalysis on and off the couch. Given that we are all facing together a crisis of unfathomable proportions, we're going to be changing the focus of our podcast. We are going to be interviewing psychoanalysts from all corners of the globe to discuss with them how their local communities are coping with this situation, how their clinical work has been affected by this situation, and also how the internal worlds of both the analyst and the patient have been impacted by this virus, as it impacts both our real fears and our imaginary fears. We're going to encounter not only uncertainty and fear, but we're also going to learn great wisdom, gifted empathy, and hope. We'll be maintaining the title of this podcast, both as a testament to our past work and as a placeholder for our future work. I hope you find these conversations both informative and sustaining. Feel free to write comments on our webpage, IPAoffthecouch.org. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Ana Catarina Duarte-Silva. Dr. Duarte-Silva is a psychoanalyst and a full member of the Portuguese Psychoanalytic Society and of the IPA. She's also a past secretary of the Portuguese Institute of Psychoanalysis, where she gives seminars, especially in the work of Winnicott, to the Portuguese Institute of Psychoanalysis. She has also published in the Portuguese Psychoanalytic Society and is the chair of the working team of the Portuguese Psychoanalytic Society, and she lives in Lisbon, where she has a private practice since 1995. As you'll hear in today's conversation, there's much talk in the field about how one's countertransference is limited by the pressing realities that we are all working under. You will hear a lovely example of a very vibrant analytic mind at work, where one's countertransference has the usual and robust freedoms that we hear today. We will hear about a patient who, though they have no body in the office, the body is missing. Turns out to be a useful way for them to explore their childhood experience of feeling like they're a nobody. This in the creative hands of Dr. Duarte-Silva. I hope you enjoy the interview as much as I do. Ana, welcome to the podcast. It's a pleasure to have you with us. Ana, we are learning that every culture, every country is facing this crisis in its own unique way. Share with us what you are learning about Portugal and Lisbon, about how your country, your culture is facing this crisis, and what you see when you look out the window.
Hello, Harvey. First of all, thank you very much for your very nice invitation. And I think these iPods out and off the couch are very important to support us all in this terrible moment we're living through. Here in Lisbon, things are quite calm compared with Italy and our neighbor Spain. We had our first case on the 2nd of March, and it has raised up slowly. We're in a state of emergency since the 19th of March, and we're going to be there until the 17th of April. We confined to our country, and we are advised to stay at home. But the city looks like a phantom. You can see some mainly joggers in the street, people walking out the dogs, and the elders walking by. These last are the less obedient, though with these rainy, cold days like today, there's no one around. There's no one in the streets.
So you're saying that the elders are out on the street. Just for our listeners to note, this is being recorded on Sunday, April 5th. And you say older people are out on the streets.
Yes, it's quite extraordinary, isn't it? But I think they're the less obedient and they don't want to carry these crucifix in their lives. So they want to go on with their lives and denying it. And I suppose, because we're going to start the Easter and the Holy Week, and the churches are all closed and everything is locked down. And so people, the elder in the neighbors, the typical neighbors of Lisbon, the eldest people, they're all walking by. When the sun comes out, they just walk by. And I think they think they're immune to this virus.
Do they keep a distance from each other when they walk?
Sometimes, but not exactly. They go on pairs to the supermarket because they have to help them with the bags and with the shopping bags. And it's very hard for them to hold them together. So usually they go on pairs. And then the police comes and send them home. But some do and some deny. But we are very obedient and very calm citizens. We're not very rebellion, you know, not like the Spanish. We're quiet.
We'll hear from the Spanish about what they think about that. Tell us about the analytic community. What's been happening in response from the community?
The analytic community, our president created on the 25th of March a telephone line, and she had this, Luisa Vicente is her name, she has this idea as a movement of solidarity and to help people to endure with the suffering that is coming from this coronavirus. I think it's a way to help them to hit this hard ball. And it had an immediate response from all of us, from the society. We're about 260. And in the first day, 70 of us, include all categories from training to candidates, they volunteer to this aid. And we have been working weekly with Zoom meetings. And on this behalf, we get in touch with each other and share some of our anguish and disquietness, which turns out to be very helpful, as it in some way supports us from this collective trauma we're all living in.
So you speak among yourselves as a community, and you're also making outreach to the public. Do I have that right?
Yes.
I see.
Yes, we have a telephone line daily from 8 to midnight. And people can telephone us through an identity of a social one. It's called Auti something, and they have this line where they can reach us. And it has been very interesting.
What have you learned? Yeah.
Yeah, we think that through these our very specific analytic listening, we can help them to understand how these external terrible situation is reactivating their internal latent anxieties, and paradoxically we try to confine their suffering to the momentaneous and virtual of the here and now of the phone call, you know. And from my experience, this confinement, this social isolation, is being mixed up with loneliness. Their fear is so present that gives them the sense of being lonely in the world, which altogether awakes their already depressing feelings. This isolation or having no one to talk to is paralyzing them, putting them back to bed to the point of being unable to accomplish their basic day routines. And what I found impressive is how during the telephone call, you can touch their relief through the phone call. And that's quite impressive and extraordinary.
Let me make sure I understand you. You're saying that in your public outreach, the community, the analytic community, and yourself. You have conversations with individuals in the public, and you perceive a number of factors. One is their loneliness, and the other is also, mm-hmm. you say, and tell me if I have this right, that this current situation, this current trauma, reactivates old traumas, lonelinesses, alienations. And part of your goal is to try to separate the past from the present for them so they can focus on what's in the here and now?
Yes, exactly. As a way to suspend the trauma feeling to the here and now, and then to continue on their mainly daily routines. It's not a therapy, it's a punctual, it's something very momentaneous, yes. These telephone yeah. calls. You're not supposed to initiate a treatment.
Sure.
Whoops.
It sounds so valuable. How long do these phone calls last?
We started on the 25th of March, so I don't
and
know.
And each phone call would be 20 minutes, 2 hours?
What? Yeah. No, it's, we're still in an experimental state, so, or phase, or a stadium. And my experience, the telephone calls are about for 20 minutes. After 10 to 15 minutes, people start to feeling relief, and they want to hang up to finish the conversation. So, and I sometimes I ask them how they feel, and say much better. It's very good to have someone to talk to.
Huh. And moving into your analytic functioning with your patients, how did the transition go from in person to online?
Well, you know. You don't know, but my husband is a medical doctor, and I was well aware of the situation. We were in Asia for the New Year Eve, and things that we were in Thailand and Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, and people were getting a little bit strange, a bit. They were all going out with masks and so on, so I kept on the news, what was going on. And my eldest son was there, and I started to feel very anxious because he was only supposed to arrive on the 28th of January. So when he arrived, I was really safe, I felt. And the other, my daughter as well, she was in Rome, and I felt very safe when they both arrived at home. It was fantastic. I have four children. And so the middle ones were out. So I was very well of the situation, the total situation, as it can possibly mean what this total situation is. So I was very well aware. My husband was telling me what was happening, the strangeness of all this. It was very unique. He never saw such an apparatus, mm-hmm. with the Chinese news and with the intensive care. And so from the middle of February, I started to prepare my patients to telesessions, whether Skype, WhatsApp, phone, etc. And, well, I have to tell you that I've been working with telesessions for about 5 years and find it very useful to psychotherapies and supervisions. But as for analysis, I think it's quite a quite different thing. And at first, they were a little bit surprised. And I sensed they thought I was being pessimist, alarmist even. But anyway, I wasn't internally prepared to interpret these feelings, as I was afraid of the real madness it brought to us. So I just let it go. Because, you know, I felt the corona madness in my last days of present practice so present that it didn't allow me to be in a state of mind of being no memory, desire, or comprehension.
That is the challenge, the literalness and the metaphoric. We are caught in the middle of it in an impossible situation, yes.
So in the 12th of March, things got worse, and I was really scared of getting infected or infecting someone, because my husband is working at the hospital. Mm-hmm. I decided to close my consulting room and finish the present sessions. And I knew that only a safe safe at my home confinement? Would I start thinking and working analytically and properly? So at first, some of the patients refuse, but I think it was the first impact, like the impact of the death drive upon them. But after a while, I think their life drive.
Let me interrupt you. Just help me with that. Is that different than denial?
I think so, because maybe I think they're the, well, let me refresh it a bit. When I think about the death drive, the refusal, maybe it's the denial. Yes, you're quite right. The denial of the death instinct and the life drive.
Right,
upon
like
it.
You were saying about the old people walking in the street. They're in denial.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, yes. It's a kind of denial, mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, it's Marie de Eisenstein talks about the sense of soft community denial
mm-hmm.
that
yes.
operates right. in us all yes. to go on living. So, but, well, I came home and we started the sessions, and I try to maintain the normal, quote and unquote, normal routines, you know. They ring the doorbell, the phone bell, we turn on the camera, and then it depends on what the patients prefer. As I try to adapt myself to their needs. So with some, we maintain the camera off and with the possibility of seeing each other whenever one wants to. You know, I put the ceiling or I put the window with some. Well, others want to turn the camera off and we just speak by phone. And the others only by phone. And I think we're all adapting.
Sure.
But nevertheless, my experience tells me today that these manners or this confinement we're obliged to allow in a way of the split of the external reality and brought up some of the very primitive anxieties, namely of disintegration and persecution, where in some cases hypochondria is at core.
Hypochondria, is that what you're saying? Yes.
Yes, yes, hypochondria. The fear of being infected, the fear of infect, and what's going to happen, even when they're very young, because I have a young population, mostly from the 20s to 40s.
Mm-hmm.
So some of my patients, but there's an interesting point, some of my patients kept on dreaming, and the majority of its contents are of fear of loss and hopelessness sometimes. But this led us to another thing from the conscious transference perspective. This put me some ideas going on. And I think this, the lack of the body seemed to put us in a transitional area where a contradictional effect appears. In one way, the lack of the body disperses my attention, you know, puts me out of focus. I found myself with the need to pay attention to what is being said, which curiously disturbs and hardens my fluctuation attention. You know, I feel less able to think and dream the patient's communication as my mind wanders sometimes where I really don't know. But in the other way, the camera, the face-to-face, the extreme presence of the other doesn't allow much absence, even if it's for a moment. And this obliges me to stay so focused. It's just like watching straight and very attentively to the ball, where to decide on from which angle you're going to hit it and to go to the other side of the court. So it makes me difficult to associate
sure.
and fluctuate.
I haven't heard that metaphor before, but I love it. That the focus, the very face-to-face focus of Skype and Zoom is the kind of focus one uses when you're playing tennis, let's say, and you really want to look very, very
yes.
closely. That's great. Yeah.
You have to have, otherwise the ball hits
sure,
your body.
Sure. Yeah, no, I get it. I just hadn't heard it before. I like it. But it nets out that in both situations, the absence of the body or the hyper-focus of the visual inhibits the analyst's mind to be playful and creative and to listen to all aspects of one's own imaginings.
Mm-hmm. I think so. But maybe it's just for these few days. I think in the initial times, maybe we can go on and develop some, but I think we all need the body. The body, sure, you know, there's a great book from Hal Webeck. It was The Impossible of an Island. And he talks about this, when there's only a soul and no bodies, only souls, only the dogs have a body. It's a very...
Can you say the name of the book again?
Michel Houellebecq. In Portuguese, it's The Impossible of an Island. He has lots of books. One of them is Submission. The other one is Routine. He's French.
Are they translated into English, Tina?
Yes, sure, it is translated. I can give you the name afterwards. This is
That'd
a book
great.
From 2010 or 12. So he goes through... He sees everything through years and in advance, you know, but it's fantastic how he writes and describes what's going to happen in our future when we don't need the body, the material, and we live only by emotions and thoughts.
Wouldn't we like to know what's in our future? Can you present some clinical material that brings your points to focus?
Yes, there was an interesting point last night. I think it might be because of our conversation. I was preparing and putting my ideas in order. I dreamt about the patient. It was a really very meaningful dream. And this helped me to put it, our relation to present in the present day where we are now. So this led me to a particular patient where this patient started the session telling me he was going to lie down on his bed and asked me what it was or what it might mean to do analysis in one bed. Another one lied down on her sofa and asked the same question. So it's very interesting because the patients are themselves asking what is the meaning of staying on their home, on their bed, lying on their places and on their body, on their couch, and yes, without seeing me. So I think this point is very interesting. Deprived from external contact, the confinement to his own bed sofa is mixed up with his being left alone to his bedroom or mine, you know. This is immersing the patient in his inner world, in a regressive movement, where he's getting in touch with his more states, primitive states of mind. And what I noticed is that this nobody, he's recalling his sense of having been a nobody in his relation to his mother or the other or the analyst, and his past feelings of being left alone came to the first surface as loneliness, where somatization was a way, you know, a warning cry, a possibility to draw attention, to be looked after and taken care of. I think it was a kind of helplessness that led to an hopelessness and led him to search for an analysis. And now, reviving this nobody with me recalls his sense of being left out, which is now demanding from me, today much more intensively than yesterday, my capacity to listen, and through my voice, as a kind of a lullaby, handle and hold his emotional state of mind as through our absence. And I'm making myself very present. It's quite extraordinary. Maybe I can explain a little bit more this idea. Because sure, is this as if through this spiritual or virtual present, we're developing abstractions and symbols where to the patient feel, and for me to feel, the presence. And I think that my dream of last night might be considered as the so-called dream for two, and it's a kind of a sign of that our unconscious is still working, because one of the things I was really I was really puzzled of is when you have the face-to-face, it seems that you can work only in an unconscious, preconscious level. You cannot go into the deeper, inner, infinite level where the wild thoughts appear. You know, you have to stay in a preconscious. But now, I think the more you go on to these modified settings, you can reach as well than conscious. And that was very helpful for me to have this dream last night. But though teleanalysis is not my cup of tea, I think I felt it very useful to both of us and to continue on living. And we'll learn something very important after this odd time, I think, because I always remember that Winnicott once told us when there were bombs flying all over the during the Second World War, during the British controversies, and once he entered the room and said, in case you don't know, there are bombs up there. And so he told us we have the obligation to keep alive and keep on living. So I think this is my motto, life.
Well, you certainly, in your example, show how lively your mind is. You and I spoke yesterday in anticipation mm-hmm. of this interview, and you used the dream you had last night to awaken something in you about your patient, which is clearly your analytic thinking is alive and vibrant and well. And the idea of there being nobody in the office to reverberate with the meaning of this young man in his childhood of feeling that he is a nobody is a wonderful demonstration of how even when faced with the literal, we can mm-hmm. always hang on to the metaphoric. Thank you for that. That was a treat. Clearly, your work sustains you during this time. Can you share with us, as we all struggle with terrible uncertainty about the future and our futures, what is it that keeps you going?
Well, my work, definitely. I think I was desperate myself if I had to stay confined to the house and doing the housework, maid work on routines and routines and routines. So, whoops. One of the things, it's my family. I live with my husband and four children. They're all at home with no boyfriends or girlfriends. Their age are 24, 22, 20, and 16. Mm-hmm. I have two little dogs, a Frenchie, a French bulldog. So the things are going okay. And this, in a way, is a tremendous time because I don't think we'll ever happen again to be the six of us.
Yes.
And we're a Latin family, so we all have our meals together, lunch and dinner. And sometimes I have my eldest daughter telling me, don't find out some more activities to fortify the bonds.
Let it be, right, Mom?
Yes. So, but this is okay. Then we have our friends and telephones and so on. And I have books and readings and working, dance and music. And I think we have my past history, my family story. So we have our defense to protect us and to keep on moving. And so I think this time we'll go over. And as in the First World War, the skirts were shortened up. And now we can wear them as we want to. So there must be some creative thing out of this, I'm sure. Don't know when.
When this is all over, the skirts will get shorter.
I don't know.
Okay.
You can. There's a fantastic. WhatsApp. A little video on the WhatsApp. It started with the movie Jojo Rabbit. Have you seen it? It was quite.
I actually haven't, but I've heard about it. Yes.
Oh, it's fantastic, and the boy is asking to the girl, "What are we going to do when the war is over?" And then you listen in the background, David Bowie, one of his music, and they start to dance. And then the movie, the video goes on for 7 minutes, the whole of that dancing through all of the films, you know. And it's very interesting. So we'll dance afterwards. We'll have to dance and we have to commemorate this. And some good thing or some creative thing will happen. We'll have a problem with the phobic people, how we will get them into our offices again, but We have to be creative and bring them back.
Anna, what a lovely way for us to close our time together on such an upbeat, optimistic note, but also contains, and it's not built on denial, it's built on real creativity and real immersion in your work and in your patients' lives and in your vibrant family life. Thank you so much for sharing. It's been a pleasure to spend this time with you.
Thank you again, Javi, and keep on going this job. It's fantastic to all of us to be in touch with each other all around the world.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.